people that whether you're winning or not winning, like, and as I said, I didn't win a single race till I was 20. I got my first podium at 19. Whether you're winning or not, if you're a true athlete and you can get up at 4:30 every morning when you're tired, your alarm goes off and you still get up to push, that sets you up, I think, in the workplace. But I think the edge is that sort of resilience, the tenacity, the values that have been instilled from losing, but also driving and just keep going no matter the adversity. I think society is a lot softer these days. Everyone wants some excuse why they can't keep pushing. And, like, as I said, I've got Crohn's. I've never said that on a publicly ever. 'Cause who gives a shit? That's for me to worry about and push through. And that's sort of the mantra I hold. And if everyone's got something going on, if you talk to someone, everyone's got something, who put that to the side and just bring your absolute best. And I think that athlete mentality of just constantly pushing, happy to be tired, being comfortable being tired, being comfortable that you might have a cold, but you're still gonna, show up. You're still going to give 110%. Having those energy levels as well and passion, you either got it or you haven't got it. And I think generally athletes, with that sort of mentality, you see them succeed whether they're in sport or not. Push on, we've got a job to do. And it's about an outcome, whether that outcome is winning a world title or delivering the report on time or whatever your KPI is, that's the win today. That's the competition. And having that, just competitive mindset to everything.
Welcome to Speaking from Water. I am your host, Sean Rutke. And today it is a very special episode. We have a world champion, a world record holder. This is Stuart McLaughlin. He is the number one paddleboarder in the world when it comes to distance and endurance. And we're so excited to have him with us. He's coming in from Newcastle, Australia. And Stuart, welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. Appreciate you having me on.
In preparation for this podcast, I did a lot of deep diving into all the content I could find about you, and your lifeguarding initially and now your paddleboarding is just superb. Your endurance abilities are super high, and I just want to say, like, congratulations for all of your accomplishments, and it must be just super super awesome just to be you and have done the things you've done.
When you put it like that, I think it's pretty awesome. Yeah. I guess you don't generally reflect on those things probably when you're in the moment, but as I'm getting towards the back end of competitive, all my competitive ability and sort of that equilibrium or curve that you go on, yeah, I'm pretty stoked to have got a few of the results under my belt that I have. Yeah.
Well, you're a professional man. We're joining you right now. It looks like at work. You're in Newcastle. It's the morning time. How are you doing today? And what's going on? Did you start your day off with a nice train?
Yeah. So my day starts, I've got two young kids. My day starts at 4:30 a.m. every day. So I can get in a session and then get them to school and get myself to work. I generally try and get on by about 8 o'clock, a little bit early this morning so I could take a break and chat to you just with all the different time zones. But yeah, I definitely, the days are pretty long to try and get training and naturally balance that with the work commitments, which is pretty intense as well. Yeah.
And you say you're kind of like towards that I guess twilight of your competition life. When did it all begin and where did it start?
Yeah, so for me, I mean, in Australia, most people that live on the coast start in the water at, yeah, well, from birth, but, do swimming lessons, do the sort of surf survival, 3, 4, 5 year olds. And then I started surf life saving about when I was 9. And that was sort of the journey of where I, you know, got the passion for being in the surf, liking the surf and wanting to be the best at anything to do with the surf. I'm definitely not the best in a lot of things to do with the surf, but I can fortunately say that I have had a pretty good shot at it with board paddling. So I was about 9 years old. And then from there, it's just taken off. And, you know, when you get to sort of the age of 16 in Australia, you can start lifeguarding, which is great. Not only it sort of follows your passion, but you also get paid pretty well in Australia for lifeguarding, which is a plus. And then from there, I've just, you know, sort of haven't lost touch with it. No matter what I do in my personal life or professional life, it still always revolves around board paddling and training. Yeah.
Sticks with you. It's so beautiful. And I'm fortunate enough to have gone to Newcastle where you're joining us from. And I believe Redhead is your home beach. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I'm fortunate enough to live about 100 meters from Redhead. And, you know, if you catch me looking across, I can see the surf from where I sit in my study. So I always like to look out, see what's going on and try and collect your thoughts at the same time. It's just a really good sort of measure to reset from. Yeah.
Epic, epic. And one of the things that struck me most about Newcastle when I visited it many years ago was this beach, Redhead, this location. Can you kind of describe Redhead to our listeners and the uniqueness of the topography and what you find to love about the water there?
Yeah, so Redhead is, unique is definitely it in Australia. So it's a coastal suburb. It's probably about 2,000 people in the suburb, but dissimilar to what you'd imagine in America or in other parts of Australia. There's no other adjoining suburbs. So we're surrounded by national park or state park, whatever it's called in the relevant countries, but it's completely surrounded by bush. And we're on a beach that's around 9 miles of just sand and waves. So there's nothing around, bush, beach and waves. And in terms of the waves, we've got a really big sort of headland on one side. And depending on the banks, you can get a good left-hander. There's a few sort of videos from the 80s and 90s where a couple of the pro surfers at the time were out there on sort of 10-foot left-handers. That doesn't happen very often, but it's a sort of an exposed south. It almost goes from south to north in terms of exposure and just gets a lot of swelling. So it's one of sort of the breaks in Newcastle you want to be on. If you're a surfer, I do surf, but I'm not that great at surfing. I can see the surfboards in the back. I'm sure. That's not my forte, but I'm definitely in the ocean a lot and enjoy being in the waves on my paddleboards. Yeah.
Can you kind of explain that culturally in Australia, as far as the surfing culture, the life-saving culture, and how the two intermingle and how they are kind of separate from your perspective?
Yeah, so, it probably depends on the beach, where you are in Australia and how close they intermingle. I think a lot of areas, clubbies or people that do surf life-saving are also surfers as well, and competitive surfers, not competitive in the sense of a world tour or those types of things, but definitely surf, you know, 3 to 5 times a week as either a sort of base. A guy I train with for the Molokai, Rory Chapman, who's done a few Molokais both on the board. I think he's got third on the SUPs and then he's done the foils as well, like a true sort of waterman. There's a lot of those that stick around the surf life saving surf culture, but then there are true people that probably go one way or the other. And I think if you're genuinely trying to be competitive or the best at something, you can't be great at everything. And I think that's probably sort of where I've had to make choices. And rather than go out for a surf, when I was sort of at the top of surf life saving, it was 7 to 8 board sessions a week. So I'd be out there, but I was just constantly on that board learning every, you know, it's the one percenters that set you apart. And that's sort of where I was focused on. So that's probably the sort of mingled relationship. I think there's a lot of people that cross between the two, but the people that cross are probably not the best of either. Yeah.
So you decided, it sounds like at an early age, that this was going to be your thing, the board. And what was it about the board at that time that you loved so much that you wanted to dedicate everything to?
I think probably in your life, you have people that you look up to. I like to think you have, you know, you look up to someone, you look forward to something or someone, and then you're always chasing someone. The people I look up to, I'm not that religious, but the people I look up to are probably not in that realm, more in a sporting realm, are sort of the idols for me. And those people were predominantly really good, either Ironmen in surf life saving or board paddlers. So Tim Foran is the guy that probably coached me for most of my development sort of stages, and still paddles with me to this day. Tim's won Molokai's. He's got a lot of medals in sort of the Australian paddle boarding scene. So I guess that's probably sort of what fueled the fire. I liked, you know, I look up to him. He's done really well, and that's the type of thing that I wanted to be. So that's sort of how I followed that path. But also, there's not really, there's probably four water sports. I mean, there's foiling now and subs, but those things weren't a thing 20 years ago in my mind. It was either swimming, surfing, board paddling, or on a ski or a kayak type thing. I'm not that well balanced, so that rules kayaking out. Swimming is pretty hard. I train it and cross train it, but if you've ever been in a swim race, particularly a triathlon or a surf race, you just end up getting drowned most of the time. So that doesn't seem like much fun. So then it's surfing or board paddling. And for me, board paddling requires a lot of resilience, a lot of tenacity, and a lot of just pushing your body to a lot of limits. I'm sure surfers will say the same, but it's not in terms of cardiovascular limits, and that I really like to hurt myself. So that's probably why I leant towards board paddling.
Well said. So swimming was never really your thing. You did it for the life, the clubbies, but you realized that was not like, you weren't hitting the pool all the time, or were you?
Well, I do 5 sessions a week.
Okay. So you are a big swimmer.
Yeah. I just don't enjoy racing it because you usually end up getting drowned. And it's not much fun, you know? Whereas board paddling, you're on the waves, you're through the waves, you're on top. It's just a lot more. I think there's just a lot more opportunity to do your own thing. Whereas swimming, it's more straight line. I think board paddling takes into account a lot of skills, trying to spot the rips, trying to spot where the chops are, find the channels. You can't do those things in swimming. It's more just who can swim the fastest. Sure, you've got to be the fastest board paddler, but you don't have to just be the fastest. You actually got to be the smartest at the same time. And I think that's what also probably attracted me. Yeah.
Well, I think I'm a rare American in that I've watched all your Nutri-Grain series you guys cover on the YouTube here in America. I'm a big fan of the Ironman and of what you guys do on your little club beaches, particularly the culture is a beautiful thing. When you were in your early days as a young kid growing up, when you did start getting into the board paddling, what particularly about the board paddling, the feeling, the being on your knees, the surfing of the wave, describe these parts to it to our audience that might not know about these factors of the sport that are so beautiful to you.
Yeah, sure. So I would say probably Australia's the mecca of surf life saving. I think that's fair to say. It's like what you see on any beach, but the boards are a lot thinner, a lot narrower than a typical lifeguard board. And they're a lot faster, which is one thing that probably appeals to me in terms of that. The second part is, so there's two styles. And when I was a younger kid, I was kneeling up. I don't kneel up anymore, but there's two styles. You can either lay down or kneel up on a board. So the ability to surf a wave, I think, is it's almost like surfing, but you're throwing in a significant sort of cardio base as well in terms of the board paddling. That's kind of something around the sport. And then in terms of what the sport is or board paddling in Australia, excluding the Molokai to Oahu and some of those longer, you know, Catalina Classic, that's not really an Australian thing. It seems like it's more of a world thing that we cross over into. The Australian sort of board paddling scene is a 4-minute max effort. You know, you're looking at about 200 meters out, round three cans or buoys, depending on what you call them, and then straight back in. So it's almost you're in that sort of anaerobic threshold the entire time is the race that we typically do. And that, I guess, It's pretty competitive as well in Australia. There it is a big sport, albeit it's not well funded or global, but it is something that everyone knows about. And what attracted me to the board part as opposed to I'm not sure, actually. I probably can't answer that part of the question. Yeah.
Yeah. So and that's a big thing here, because it's a very short race of high octane compared to what your world record is in the Molokai and your four championship wins there. When were these first early victories for you? When did you start seeing big success in your surf life saving events?
Yeah, so I didn't win a single race at a state level, which is, or a national level, till I was 19 years old, which I think is actually a good thing. I think losing as a kid teaches you a lot of valuable lessons. I despise losing now. So last year in Molokai, where my board broke and I ended up third and, you know, paddled the stock board for 51 of the 54 Ks in an unlimited category. Good achievement, but I'm absolutely seething that I lost. But having lost for so many years, you know, and not winning till I was, say, 19, or actually at 19, I got third. So it's the first time I've ever, you know, hit a podium, teaches you how to lose and how to lose well. Albeit no one likes losing. And anyone that says that they are okay with losing, I think is either should see someone and get some help, or is lying, because winning is just, the feeling of winning is amazing. But I also equally think you need to be okay with losing. Which I am, but albeit I don't like it. So my first success was about 19. And then from there, it just continued on a really steep trajectory. So the next year I won in my first year open. So when you're 19 years old, you move to an open category. You're out of age groups from 19 till about 30 years old in Australia. And I've won more state and Australian board titles than anyone this century. So, you know, the only person that's people that have beat me in terms of titles is Mick Porra, who, you know, you might know from sort of the surfing world of Porra names. But, you know, he was around a lot of the other sort of motocross events as well. You know, I think he started Nitro Circus. But those sorts of, Mick Porra won six titles in the 80s. And in those times, it was a different format. So you would finish in the water, whereas now you have to sort of link. You have to not just be the fastest board paddler, the smartest board paddler. You also have to have an explosive start and finish, because you're finishing on the beach, as in there's a lot of running. And generally in Australia, it comes down to a wave, as in there'll be two people on that wave and you'll be running up the beach. So who can get off their board? Who can do those finer skills? So it's linking everything. Whereas in the olden days, it was, you would finish in the water. So you wouldn't get off your board. So it's a different era. And then the other person who has five titles, so I have four, is Trevor Hendy. So for any of the listeners that follow, you know, Australian surf life saving or Ironman, Trevor Hendy is the icon of icons, the name of names, and, you know, someone that is pretty well renowned. And to, you know, to have him as the only person that's got more titles, but albeit in a different era, I'm happy to be sitting there. Yeah.
Well, bro, congratulations again. And can you tell our listeners what years those were, just for the chronological?
Yeah, so my Australian titles, and you know, I'm only one of two people to win three in a row, Mick Porra and I, which is, so it's not just about how many you win. If you can win back to back, obviously the chances of doing that over and over, it, you know. So I won in 2013 the Australian board title. I won in 2014. I won in 2015, and I won in 2018. And the other thing, you know, of all those, which I'm pretty proud of, is I haven't missed an Australian final since I was in Opens, excluding 1 year. So that's 17 years of finals, which, as you can appreciate, takes a lot of, you know, sacrifice from me, but also my family. Like, I've got a really supportive wife and wider family that helped me, because without them, you can't do that sort of level of training. But yeah, something that I'm pretty happy to say I've made the finals, which is, in Australia a huge achievement. If you make a final, anything from there is a plus.
Yeah. You're a household name. This is a massive, any listeners out there who aren't familiar with this, it's the creme de the creme. And I'd like to know which of those races is the most memorable, means the most. And if you could give us kind of a glimpse into what that race was like.
I think the most memorable was 2014. So that's my second title. I think when you win one, there's always naysayers and people saying you were lucky or, you know, oh, it's just a fluke, an outlier, those types of things. But when you can back up the next year, that generally puts a lot of those people or silences a few of those people. But in 2014, I won that race it was choppy. So it was kind of like a Molokai chop. It was 45 degrees over one shoulder. We're in WA in Perth on Scarborough Beach. It's where the Doctor race is held. If anyone that listens does, you know, it's not held in Scarborough, but it's similar winds and it's held in Perth. If anyone does ocean kayaking, the Doctor race is a pretty big sort of world event. So it was about 10 or 11 in the day. There's a howling quartering chop coming over my right shoulder as I'm paddling from the last can in. And I turn the last can, which is the, you know, there's three cans you go around or buoys. I turn the last can in first, but I would have turned already 10 meters ahead. And it was whilst it was choppy, there are no waves. So I genuinely just out paddled some people. And I'd also, you know, probably with that cornering chop, it pushes a lot of people down. So to get around the first can I took the whole field off course. So they're all getting washed and couldn't get around the can and whatever else, which allowed me to have a lot more room. And coming in, I would have won that race by 30, probably 30 meters. And I just remember the feeling, you know, I'm already chatting to someone and then second place hasn't finished and it's just in chops, which I was just absolutely stoked to be able to open the field up like I did. And I think sometimes, you know, there'll be people that listen that think, oh, wow, you know, I'm super fit. I know I can win this race, but it doesn't always come together. In that race, for me, it came together. Everything I wanted to happen happened, and I just had the perfect execution. So, and that showed in the result and how, you know, sort of the distance I was able to put into household names like Kane Eckstein and, at the time, Hugh Doherty was there as well. These are sort of names of a different era, but Kane Eckstein's obviously the brother of Shannon Eckstein and, you know, 9-time Nutri-Grain Ironman, probably the best of the modern era. And Kane is just as incredible. Someone that's never won an Australian board title, but someone that, you know, people go, well, who were you most scared of? Kane would be one of those names when I was racing, thinking, you know, I don't want to come up next to him on the way in. So to do that when he's in the race, I was pretty stoked about it. Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful. And now speak to the wave that brings you in and that could take you from a 10th position into a first position or ruining you depending if you're in first. Because there is so much variable there at that period of turning that apex buoy and coming back to the beach as far as what the ocean delivers from the back. What is your thought on that?
That's the best part of the sport. It's the worst part as well. So 2016, I was going for my fourth title in a row. So there's only four people that have won two titles in a row in the history of the 120 years of board paddling in Australia. That's Steve Warren, Mick Porro, Trevor Hendy and I. There's only two people that have won three in a row, Mick Porro and I, and I was going for four in a row, which would have equaled the record. 2016, we're at the Sunshine Coast, Sunshine, whatever you call it, but at Maroochydore, which is just south of Noosa, I think, heads, but really close to Noosa, say 10 minutes, give or take. I'm not, you know, we're 9 hours from there. So if it's 20 minutes, I apologize to anyone from Noosa, but around Noosa Heads, Noosa Beach, those sorts of things is Maroochydore. The Australian titles were there and it was probably 4 or 5 foot swell, howling winds. I turned the can in second trying to go for that win. I thought I was you know, I actually felt pretty comfortable and thought, well, I probably got this because I held a better line and I was just waiting for a wave. I end up coming in a place they don't hand out decals for, and I don't think they pat you on the back a long way back. The person who won it was a guy called Hayden White, and he turned the last can 16th. By the time he turned the can, I was already in the wave zone. That's how far behind he was. He picked up a wave from the can, went past the entire field. And, you know, as you can appreciate, on some beaches, there's waves that unless you have the momentum, you can't get through the gutter or you can't get through where it reforms. He took it all the way to the beach, won by 15 meters and was dead last at the third can. So it's sort of those things are what make surf life saving, I think, because it gives everyone the opportunity, no matter, you're always in with a shot. But equally, if I'm behind, those things can also happen. So, it does sort of energize everyone in the race, but also can be quite frustrating if you've done the work and you think you've set up that race for success and then that doesn't happen. So, yeah, that's the type of scenario of the waves coming through and you're always looking over your shoulder. I do like to think, though, if you've assessed the conditions, you've really sort of designed where you're going to be on the way in, you can generally, miracles or luck always happens, but you can generally try and design how the race is going to go yourself as long as you are pretty disciplined about it. Yeah.
And you use the word design. How do you design a race in advance with an ocean that is so unpredictable?
Yeah, so for me, as I said before, Tim's one of my, you know, coaches at the time. Sort of when I was those ages, I was say 22, 23, I legitimately had coaches. So it's about sitting down with those people. It's about trying to read the ocean. And prior to a race, you get told where you're going to be on the start line. Stuff's always moving, but you've probably got three scenarios that are going to play out when the gun goes. And depending on what happens when the gun goes, I either go for scenario A, B, or C. And whether that's I've got the better end, the wave looks great, so I'm going to get a good skim and get my board momentum up, or and just go and get out in front and from there just stay there, or whether it looks like I'm on a bad end, I'm going to run down, or I'm going to try and just get through the break and ease up on the pedal and let someone else go around. So in board paddling, there's a wash on the side of the boards particularly that's really, really good. So if you can get through the break and jump on someone's sidewash, you can conserve a lot of energy and just wait till the weigh in to really, so there's different plans, and that's how I would design my race to win. And it really depends on the conditions, my overall fitness and how I'm feeling on the day as to what I'm going to try and execute. And then obviously advice from people around me as well. And I weigh all those things up probably before the gun goes, and it's split second decisions as soon as it does. Yeah.
Epic. And this knowledge can only come from just being on this board, I assume, for so many hours in training and practice. What kind of practice and training were you doing at this time?
Way too much. I genuinely believe, albeit I was a board paddler in, you know, in inverted commas, as opposed to an Ironman, I reckon I was fitter than any Ironman on the circuit. I just couldn't put all three legs together. So I would routinely do 16 sessions a week. I'd do 5 to 6 swims, 5 to 6 board paddles. I'd do 4 to 5 runs, generally soft sand runs with sort of dunes. And then I would do, after every session, 30 minutes of core. So I could be doing 15 core sessions a week. And that includes, you know, 50 chin-ups every session. I was just super fit. So I would train mornings up at 4:30. I would, if I could, at that time I was a bit younger, so I had a bit more flexibility in my work life. If I was lifeguarding, I'd be training the day. So we get, you know, when we were lifeguarding, we would have not only our break, but also a bit of time to train as part of our shift. So I'd be doing, you know, 8 to 10K soft sand runs, shuttle runs, gym, whatever I could get my hands on, and then in the afternoon backing it up on the board. So easy 15 sessions a week plus cores, sometimes more. I was doing a lot. Something that my body couldn't handle anymore. Yeah.
Incredible. And how did you know when it was time to recover when you're pushing yourself so much?
You
didn't. You just went.
I didn't recover. I just kept going. And I think that's the difference as well. So, you know, when I was winning, I didn't have off seasons. I did 12 months straight and kept going for the next 12 months and the next 12 months. I didn't have breaks. I didn't have days off. If I was sick, I would train, which is a bit different, I think, now. But I've got, like, my firm belief is I'm not that talented. I just work hard. And, you know, there's a famous quote around hard work beats talent. And I'm a firm believer of that. So I like to rock up to every start that I do, including Molokai, and know that I've done, or I've been the hardest worker on the line before we go. Yeah.
Dude, it's so inspiring. Now, when during this, because it's, again, a short distance, when did you decide, I want to do the Molokai distance race, which is a 5-hour, right? I mean, it's a grueling cross between two islands in the Hawaiian island chain. And it's like a sprinter who does track, then going on to do ultra distance marathoning. It seems like it's two different body mindsets. Why first of all, and then what was that path like?
Yeah, so I guess in Australia, I think if you ask people, would they rather an Australian board title or a Molokai title, I think they'd say Australian board title, just because of how, you know, the sort of, that is the pinnacle of board paddling for our country. But in the world, I don't think they would say that. So if you ask the sort of board paddlers across the US or in Europe or France, Spain, unless you're sort of winning Molokai or potentially Catalina, it's not really you're not classed a board paddler. Whereas I would say, if you want to be the best in the world, you win an Australian board title, and you are. So for me, it was about ticking off another thing to say, well, this is the resume, good luck with it. And I look forward to the people over the next 30 years trying to beat it, you know? So I wanted to get there. And the other thing I'd say is I saw Molokai as something I wanted to tick off, because some of those idols that I look up to. So Tim has won Molokai, my coach. He's won the stock division. I'm pretty competitive with him, and I knew I wanted to go faster than him. And I've told him he's pretty shit at it. And now I've got, you know, the time to prove that I'm better. Albeit you can say conditions change every year. But the other thing we do, so a lot of my training program with Tim back in the early days was all about chop chasing. So it wasn't, you know, we'd do some short, sharp efforts. We'd do the absolute grinds of 10 4-minuters just in the dead flat max effort. Things I would never do now, because A, I'm older, hopefully a bit smarter, and B, can't be bothered with that sort of stuff. I'd rather enjoy my training and try and do downwinders or go for trail runs with the guys or whatever it is. But then, so that was, you know, one of our main training programs was about that chop chasing. So it's about going, you're almost in 120%. I know that's not a numeric number, but you're overdrive. You're almost spinning your arms faster than it's possible to spin your arms in any normal scenario when you're chasing chops, and then you're resting and then you're going again. So we did a lot of that stuff. We had a lot of, around here, there's a really good northeast run. There's a really good southerly run, all about an hour long. And I'd consider myself, Tim, and the guys that I were training with, like Rory, some of the best chop chasers or the best chop chasers in the world. So when you see people in Molokai that are, you know, winning that race and saying that they're the best, that sort of fueled my fire to go, well, you might just be the best because I'm not there, or Tim's not there, or the guy I'm training with isn't there. That's cool, but, you know, watch out. And I guess the thing that, why I wasn't there earlier, I found it really hard. So to win in 2018 for my Australian title was probably the second most memorable, because I found it really hard to transition back from long distance to a 4-minute race, albeit I've got two things working against me: A, training for the long distance, and B, getting a lot older. So that sort of fast twitch stuff it's really hard to get the power efforts at 35, 36, I find. But I'm really glad that I didn't go to Molokai before sort of the age of 27, 28, because I think it really would have impacted what I'd done over here in sort of short distance paddling. So main reasons is, yeah, I wanted something on my resume from a world level, that I think has a lot more credibility and standing across other countries than the Australian title does. And B, I wanted to prove that the times people were doing over there wasn't actually where they should be. And I was going to bring a new era to the stock paddling, which I think I have. And if people don't think I have, well, that's a matter for them, you know?
Love it, dude. So what was arriving in Oahu? Was that your first trip when you went to for your first race? What was that like? And what was your mentality, your feelings going into that first race before you laid your mark?
I've never been to Hawaii, and now I've obviously been there over and over and over again. It doesn't get any easier, I would say. For me, like, it just seems easier in Australia. Everything just seems easier. It's really hard for Australians to... It's getting to the start line is harder than the actual race. And it still is for me 7 years on, just organizing shipping of boards. You know, I'm about to ship one out for the Unlimited because my last one broke. Don't want to talk about that, but there's a new one coming. And like, just that has been 3 months of effort. There's so much admin and so many customs things in America it's an unfriendly race for people, particularly from Australia, I think, the effort to get there. So that to me was really daunting. And particularly the first year, I was lucky to have and still do Brad Gall, who's won the race a couple of times on Unlimited. Now in Hawaii, and Mikey Kote and Big Mike, who was also won the race and, you know, Hawaiian based. Those guys helped me out a lot. I think though, without people helping you, it's almost impossible. So it was really, really tough the first year and really daunting. When I got to the Molokai, it's like Jurassic Park, I would say, is what I picture. That's what I relate Molokai to. It's like this sort of desolate place, but really unique, and just, you know, you have the monk seals sitting on the beach every year. It's half the buildings are dilapidated and half aren't. It just screams Jurassic Park for me. And getting there was an effort, but once you're there, it's pretty surreal, but I don't think it's gotten any less nerve wracking over the years. It's just such a long way to paddle. And no matter how many times you've paddled, it doesn't get easier, I don't think. I actually think it gets worse because you are so familiar with where you are in the channel and how much longer to go. And the first year was just insane. I just remember, you know, I was racing. I think there was Nick Fox, who had won a lot of the races over there and been on Hawaii for a couple of months doing a lot of the, you know, the Turtle Beach race. There's the Hawaii Man or whatever it is that's run from the canoe club that runs down Hawaii Kai from Sandy Beach and then finishes the canoe club. There's a few of those pre-races. He'd won a lot of them. So there was a lot of talk about how fast he was paddling. There was obviously Lockie Lansdowne and Jack Bark as well, who had been in the race a lot of times, and you just can't tell. Obviously, my mantra is just do the work, and hopefully, you know, if you've generally been or done more than anyone else, well, the results will probably take care of themselves. But I just hadn't had any markers against those people. They're not really names in, you know, like Lockie is great at the Molokai, but I've never seen him in an Australian board final, you know, like it's a complete, and that was my thing. And now I'm coming over here. So how do you know if you're going to go against someone in you would smash them in a 4 minute race, but in a 5 hour race, it's completely different. This is their thing. So it was pretty daunting, I would say. And I remember my plan was to let the names be the names and just go and have my own race and get away from everyone as quickly as I could. And then just focus on my own paddle. So I went off the start like it was a 4 minute race, and I haven't seen them since. And I think that was what won me the race, as in, had I tried to let them control the narrative for 5 hours, I don't think I would have won. But getting out and just then focusing on my own chops, my own lines, everything that I do every, you know, day in, day out, it enabled me to just get out of the headspace of racing someone for 5 hours and racing more myself. Yeah, it's an incredible experience. And anyone that ever wants to have a really life-changing moment, I would suggest train for the Molokai and sign up, because no matter whether you're first, last, or somewhere in between, it's just something that really sets you up for life. And that, not just the race, as I said, that the lead up to the race is just as hard as the actual race. Yeah.
And at what points in this grueling affair across the channel, where are the mental breakdowns? Is it when you can't see anything around you? Is it when, explain that.
Yeah. I think, without sounding too corny, you go through like a roller coaster of emotions. It's almost like that Simpsons episode where you're like, you know, you go through denial, you know, no, I'm not going to die. And then all the way through to acceptance. Oh, well, I'm going to die, you know, so be it. Let's move on. But I actually think you to and fro through a really good headspace to a really bad headspace. That's personally me. And I think the problem, most of my mental barriers is about trying to understand where people are, because in the ocean, as soon as you're a minute away in Molokai from anyone, they've disappeared. You could be a minute in front, a minute behind, a minute to the right, doesn't matter. You can't see them. So whilst I try and have my own race, I like to know particularly whether that own race is holding pace or whether I need to increase my pace or find a better line. Because out there, the water is constantly changing and there is legitimately better lines to be had, particularly from a current perspective rather than a wind or chop. You can have the best chops in the world, but if you're going against the current, you're in the wrong place. You know, you're not gonna win that race. So that's probably the mental barrier for me. I go through sort of three main cycles in the race. The first hour and a half, I'm in a really good place. Probably between an hour and a half and 3.5 is a bit dicey, because you're starting to, you know, the sinking, that sort of initial adrenaline and non-fatigue stage is over and you're now starting, no matter how much training you've done, it's starting to hurt at an hour and a half, especially if you're pushing the pace. But from 3.5 onwards, it's just an awesome experience again, because you can see the island. It's actually legitimately closing. In terms of the distance, you can see yourself getting so much closer and the adrenaline comes back in. And generally I switch to flat coke at about 4 hours. And once you switch to flat coke, if anyone's near me, good luck. Cause you know, I just get the biggest kick from that. Getting off my nutrition and onto coke. It's really the race is over from there. Yeah.
Flat coke. And I understand you have a nutrition sponsor. What kind of nutrition are you taking before the flat coke?
Yeah, so I use Infinite Nutrition. I have, forever. Infinite is an American brand, and then there's a subsidiary in Australia called Infinite Nutrition Australia. It's completely liquid nutrition. I don't use gels. I don't use food. A lot of the pro tri guys are using it. And I guess I was fortunate enough to find it through some of my tri mates that I train with. And I've got, I've got Crohn's disease as well. So I've been across the channel when I've had flares, which isn't an amazing, but believe it or not, I broke the world record with a flare going on. So that's kind of thing. But for me, I've done endurance events before just to get fit, you know, like Ironman events, and had gels and they just upset my stomach, my bowel, and that's something you don't want to experience in a Molokai race, because there aren't any toilets around, you know. So it's about finding what works for you. But in addition to finding what works for you from a physical sense, or, you know, keeping going or sustaining your energy levels, for me, more importantly, it's about something that doesn't upset your stomach. So when you're out there for five, like I have a very small breakfast on race day. There's not much lining on my stomach. So you need something that's really soft on your stomach. Otherwise, if you have a bad day out there with nutrition, it doesn't matter how good your training was or how good you are at board paddling, you're not going to be winning the Molokai. Yeah.
And I understand from a previous interview I watched with you and your wife. Your wife actually jumps off the boat a few times during the race to give you new nutrition. Can you explain that relationship?
Well, I don't think she'd look at it as a favorable relationship. She actually just said this morning, you know, you're going to make me dive in and throw up again. So my wife is, yeah, she's been my water boy or water girl for four of the six so far races. And I've had my brother-in-law the other two because she was pregnant, you know, sort of 35 weeks. And I don't think that's very safe. But yeah, so you have a bottle on your board. My bottle carries 700 mil. You generally achieve about a 600 mil ratio out of each bottle. Either, you know, because your straw doesn't reach far enough or, you know, the waves, you know, or swells are pushing the liquid around. For me, I look for every advantage. So I don't have a straw in my bottle. My bottle tilts down, so there isn't a straw, because that's about 100 grams that I can get rid of weight off my board. So that puts me about 570 mils out of a bottle, which means I about every 38 minutes I need to change it for nutrition to get the right amount of liters per hour. And you do those sorts of things through sweat tests and just feel. So in training, I kind of work out what I need per hour and how many scoops of carbs and, you know, and complex carbs that I may need and go from there. But so she'll jump in every 38 to 40 minutes. How those changes work for us is the boat will go ahead about 200 meters, try and get into where they think I'm going to be. And she'll dive in with fins on and swim out and hold the bottle, and I'll turf the one behind me. She'll try and find it. And I'll just grab it from her and stick it in my frame. So you have a drink bottle frame that's just like a mountain bike or road bike drink bottle holder cage. Or generally you do. This year we're trying something different. There will be no frames. It's built into the board to try and get the center of gravity of the board down. And I look forward to hopefully making that a success. But yeah, so you change those things. I guess for her, it's the worst experience of her life. For me, it's kind of, well, it is what it is. As long as I get the bottle, I don't really mind. But she's, you know, she's been seasick. She's been stung by jellyfish. She's had to jump in. The best one was, we're about an hour from Oahu and there was just a pack of birds everywhere and it smelt like fish. You know, when you're out in the water and you go, you may not see a shark, and I've definitely seen sharks in the race, but you may not see one, but you just get the sense they're there, you know? And I've called for the bottle and she's, you know, she's sort of done the, I'm not coming, no, wait. And, you know, by 4 hours into the race, you're generally pretty cranky. So there was a lot of expletives let out on my behalf. I'm not proud of it, but nonetheless, I got the bottle and she jumped into the pack of birds, you know, fishy smell. And I don't think she's forgiven me since for it. But I like to think that's history. You know, we got the win and you cannot do the Molokai without someone in your corner on the boat. And I'm fortunate enough that she's happy to be there. Yeah. Well, I don't know if she's happy to be there, actually. She's married. It's kind of, she needs to, you know. But she gets, you know, she gets a holiday in Hawaii. I try and find something to reward her for the shit experience that I put her through. Yeah.
It sounds like a beautiful relationship you guys have. You mentioned losing at the start of the podcast and the value of losing. You have so many wins now under your belt. So the power, the feeling that you must get during that moment when you cross the finish line, can you express to our listeners what that feels like?
It's difficult to describe. But when, like for Molokai, so for me, it's now, you know, what I try and do is maintain my fitness from the last race as best as possible, whilst sort of maintaining that sort of professional career going on as well, and family life, 4 and 6 year old, you know, you can imagine what's going on there. But try and maintain a base, and then there's a 16 week push. And in those 16 weeks, you know, I'm not around that much on weekends. My wife's having to make lots of sacrifices to her own personal life as well. So that sort of, and the reason I say that is that builds into that feeling when you cross the line, because so many people, you know, my whole family will be there. My mum and dad, last year, dad was there. He was in hospital for 6 days, had heart failure. Like, this race means a lot to not just me. There's a tribe behind you that come along, or in my life there is. And I think a lot of people sort of have that family movement behind them in the Molokai. So when you've got all these people that are either, you know, sponsoring you, investing in your training with you, or making sacrifices so you can train, when you cross that line, if you've achieved the goal, whatever that goal is, and for me, it's always win and break the record. Now, the record is difficult to break if you don't have the right conditions. I get that, but that's still the goal. So when those two things line up, and you know, like 2019, I was in a bit of a dogfight, only 3K out, and I got the win by a minute and a half or 2 minutes, which, you know, 2 seconds or 2 hours is still a win, but 2 minutes isn't that long. And a lot of that 2 minutes was in the last 2K, where, you know, Lockie just blew up in terms of in the headwind. But when those sorts of things happen, you know, you've sort of battled, you know, how much sacrifices happen. When you cross the line, it's not just a feeling of elation. It's a feeling of absolute achievement, even though you may have achieved it before. It's just that, and probably achievement in the sense of your programs worked, everything you've done was what you needed to do, which, no matter how many times you've won or not won, you never truly know until the race is done whether it's going to work. But yeah, it's just raw emotion. You can't explain, other than it's an insane feeling. And every year I go, generally before the race, this is it. I'm not doing it again. I'm done. I've said that in 2016. I'm only going to do it once. I want to win. I'm done. 2017, I've said it. And as soon as you finish the race, by the time, and I say this in one of my videos, but by the time I've got to presentation, I've already booked my accommodation on Molokai. So I've locked in the joint I want to be at. And we're coming back. I haven't spoken to my wife. I haven't spoken to my family, but we're coming back. So hopefully that gives, you know, the people listening that sort of sense that it's an absolute body breaker, and you go through so many emotions, but within 5 minutes of the race finishing, the feeling that I've already gotten, everything that I've hated about the build up, the training, the sacrifice, the, you know, not seeing your friends even, you know, I will see them for a coffee after a training session, and that's about it in terms of catching up with anyone. It's just work and train, work, train. All those sacrifices just fade into the abyss, and the things that you know, you're not going to do it again, all gone, and I'm booked and I'm coming back. And it's all on that feeling. So that's how incredible it is for me.
Beautiful. Just so beautiful. And then how does that carry into your professional work life? Does that also elevate and rise because you've accessed this power?
Definitely. So I like to think people that, whether you're winning or not winning, like, and as I said, I didn't win a single race till I was 20. I got my first podium at 19. Whether you're winning or not, if you're a true athlete and you can get up at 4:30 every morning when you're tired, your alarm goes off and you still get up to push, that sets you up, I think, in the workplace. What I do for work, you know, I'm pretty senior for my age. And I think that's, like, sure, I've got different degrees behind me and masters and whatever, but it's that the edge for, I think, and who knows, my boss might say something different, or maybe the people that report to me, but I think the edge is that sort of resilience, the tenacity, the values that have been instilled from losing, but also driving and just keep going no matter the adversity. I think society is a lot softer these days. Everyone wants some excuse why they can't keep pushing. And, you know, like, as I said, I've got Crohn's. I've never said that on a publicly ever, because who gives a shit? That's for me to worry about and push through. And that's sort of the mantra I hold. And, you know, if everyone's got something going on, you know, if you talk to someone, everyone's got something, who put that to the side and just bring your absolute best. And I think that athlete mentality of just constantly pushing, happy to be tired, being comfortable being tired, being comfortable that you might have a cold, but you're still going to, you know, show up. You're still going to give 110%. Having those energy levels as well and passion, that stuff you can't, I think you can't, well, you can learn to an extent, so that's probably wrong, but to the point that you can't learn, somebody, you either got it or you haven't got it. And I think generally athletes, you know, with that sort of mentality, you see them succeed whether they're in sport or not. I think that's the difference for me in the workplace, is that tenacity, the resilience, the high energy, and the just being comfortable, being uncomfortable. It doesn't matter. Push on. We've got a job to do. And it's about an outcome, whether that outcome is winning a world title or delivering the report on time or whatever your KPI is, that's the win today. That's the competition, and having that, you know, just competitive mindset to everything. People will, you know, I'm sure there's lots of literature about competitions, you know, driving, you know, negative results. Well, good for them, but that's not my belief. Yeah.
Incredibly inspiring. And your father, you said you have a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old. What are you instilling in them as a world-class athlete? I'm thinking more like, how do you not go overboard? What's your approach to fathering young athletes?
My wife is also very sporty, or was. She was in the Australian Junior Olympic team. So, you know, we come from sort of a sporting mentality. But what we're trying to do with them is whatever they want to do, we're comfortable with, giving them exposure to all types of sports. But more importantly, really trying to instill that you don't have to win. Because obviously they've seen trophies, they've seen races, they've come to Molokai and watched me win. But trying to instill that, particularly, you know, I may go to a race and I'm not going to win. I'm racing this weekend. I'm a bit older. And as I said, I'm having a really hard time transitioning to a 4-minute race at the moment, albeit I was the top of the top at that sport. It's difficult, but trying to get them comfortable with losing. So that's my main focus, is it's okay to lose. And you're going to lose a lot. But it's how you build from a loss, how you respond to a loss, that are the important things in life and that people will judge you on. So for me, it was being a good loser, but also letting that loss or losing drive my behavior, which was, I'm going to be better. I'm going to train harder. I want this. And if you truly want it, then I'll support my sons, Harvey and Sydney. If they want to be the best, I'll support them to be the best. But if their behavior, I'm sounding really like a dad now, but if their behavior is not great when they lose, I'm going to be the first person to pull that up, because you need to really be, I think before you're a winner, you need to be a good loser.
What are they interested in right now? Is there anything that they're super passionate about, like yourself?
Yeah. So my son, my 4-year-old is really interested in board paddling, loves watching my races. How sad is that? But also he's got things going on. So my son's in a wheelchair at the moment. He's got a collapsed hip bone and whatever else going on. So sport's out for him a little bit. My other one is loving tennis. Went to his first tennis comp on the weekend and didn't win a single point in 4 different tennis matches. And, you know, I think that was the best experience for him. I hope he doesn't win for a long time, because my firm belief is losing teaches you to win, and teaches you some really valuable lessons in life. So his main passion at the moment's probably tennis, but everyone in Australia loves water as well. So swimming is a thing. You know, he loves swimming. We've got a pool. He's in the pool every day. I hope he doesn't turn out to be a swimmer is probably my thing. I just can't stand sitting in a chlorine sort of environment. They're not the best places to spectate sport. Whereas, you know, going to the Australian Open, I could see myself there if he ends up, you know, wanting to be a world-class tennis player. That'd be awesome.
Beautiful, beautiful. And before we let you go, you're at work again. We always end these podcasts with a deep, profound question. What is the meaning of life according to Stuart McLaughlin?
Jesus, I didn't know that one was coming. What's the meaning of life? You know what? I'll probably go to something I saw and I said earlier, but for me, life is about having someone to look up to, having something to always look forward to, and having someone or something to chase. And I know who said that, but I'll let, you know, if your listeners can work it out, good on them. But it was recently said and it just resonated so well with me. And, you know, no surprise, someone to look up to is my idols in board paddling. Something to look forward to is my family, and having time with them and having the ability to offer them the opportunities that they want. And something to chase, I like to think, is my future self. Always looking forward, trying to be better every day. Yeah.
That was deeply profound and just beautifully moving. I have chills. Let me get a PS question from you. How are you feeling going into this year's race? And what are you, where is your heart? Where is your mind?
I can tell you, I didn't sign up to this year's race to lose. I'm looking forward to burying some people out there this year. And if I don't, I just know that I'll have done everything possible with my body that I can to make it happen. You know, I'm older. I had arm surgery last year. I've already got a broken knee, so I'm reducing the Ks in my legs. I've got to have surgery after Molokai to screw my knee back. It's broken, but I'll do every possible thing to win that race this year. This is the one. And I won't be back individually after this. I think the time is for, you know, my family, my wife, her career, those types of things. But look, if you see me not win, I'll be seething about it, but I'll be a humble and good loser. But for me, this year's race, I'll have turned every possible stone with my 35, 36 year old body to bury some people in that channel. And God help whoever signs up, because I'm going there for one goal, and that is to win. And if the conditions allow it, that's to break the record.
What a weapon.
So good luck to them. And if they beat me, good on them. They've obviously done some serious work and they deserve it. So I'll be the first person to shake their hand and probably say, if I was only 10 years younger, I probably would have got you, you know. But no, I'm not going to use age. If I win this year, I think I was talking to Brad, I'll be the oldest person to ever win the race. And I want to put that on the resume as well. So I'm honestly going to be giving, you know, my training starts firmly in 2.5 weeks. And, you know, I think people in my workplace can tell when I'm training for Molokai, because I'm generally a lot crankier. Because, you know, you're generally fatigued a lot more.
So are you putting in more distance at that time? Is that your mentality?
Yeah. So, essentially Saturdays is a big training session. So I build Saturdays all the way through to 6 hours, paddles. And then on the back of 6 hours, I'm doing core sessions. I'm doing an hour run, assuming my knee can cope with an hour. And then I'm doing an hour swim. Like, I'm doing 8 hours on a Saturday, which usually I would do 2 hours. So I'm building to huge volumes, and just hoping the body holds up. And it's a 12-week program or 13-week program. And then I hit Hawaii for 3 weeks to acclimatize, get the board running, and hopefully get the win.
Do you taper?
No, there's no taper. I mean, I never taper. Excluding Molokai, which would be from the Wednesday to the Sunday of the race, I don't do any paddling. And mostly that's not really for the paddling. It's just really fatiguing in Hawaii, the sun, and trying to get out of the sun is more the issue than the paddle itself. And I like to think by that stage, if you haven't got it, you're not going to have it.
And swimming, I swim every day. I'm a big proponent of the swimming. Yeah. You do swim every day, you said?
Yeah, so I'm doing 5 sessions a week. I'll build that to 7 sessions a week, but I'm not doing super distances. It's about 4K a session. And I do, I don't do any more, not that I couldn't do more. It's more trying to manage your shoulders. So you got to be careful how much you put through your shoulders, how much you put through your knees, your legs. So I'll really try and vary the training program to do, hit different parts of the body, albeit some of those parts you may not need for the race, but it's about building that cardiovascular sort of fitness is my main goal, because, you know, if you put me in a wind, you know, choppy conditions today, I can paddle the board. It's just how fit I can get.
And you find that the pool at 4K is a session really gets you in a place cardiovascularly and muscularly with your shoulders. That's a positive daily routine.
Yeah, definitely complements it. And they're quality sessions. You know, we're doing 3K main sets. They're not, we're not just there swimming around. It's get in, get out, get the quality done in an hour.
I am a man. I do 5Ks. I do 4Ks a day, 5 days a week myself. And each one is 1,000 in 14 minutes. I'm sorry to go over here a little bit, but like speak to the power of the flip turn here. Cause I'm bringing surfers to the pool. I'm trying to get them in the water because they're like, oh, it's flat, but I'm not in shape. I'm like, dude, the pool's there every day just for you to grind it out. Yeah. And they can't get on the flip turn mindset. Like, speak to the power of the flip turn and what that does to you just spiritually and emotionally without stopping at the walls.
Yeah, you can't do a swim session if you're not tumble turning. You're not getting the right cycle. I don't think you're getting the right sort of fitness either. So if you're touch turning, it's not as hard either. So it's slower, but it's not as hard. So when you're tumble turning, then you're coming off the wall with one or two kicks, whether you're a good swimmer or not. It's that extra sort of breath work that you're having to do that then makes the next lap a lot harder and trying to get down on the cycle. So we've got a couple of touch turners. They're generally triathletes, but it sounds like in America they might be surfers. It's different. You need to learn to tumble turn. The way I've taught my sons is get a broomstick and get them to go over the broomstick in a circular sort of fashion. But it makes the sessions that much harder. And if you're not tumble turning, you're not swimming. Yeah.
Completely agree. Stu, I cannot thank you enough for taking your time out of your workday to join us and just fill us. Even if you're not a swimmer or a paddler, anyone who comes across this podcast is going to gain so much just mental strength to take with them into their daily life from the words you've said today. So I thank you sincerely from the bottom of our hearts for coming on the program.
No worries. Thanks for having me, Sean. It was great to be on and have a chat, and, you know, hopefully I'll be able to reach out to you in about 5 months time and talk about all the people I buried out there, and hopefully they lost their souls, you know?
Like I was saying at the start of the talk here, I'm helping my friend Rob Brown. He's going to be out there doing it.
Yeah.
And, I hope that I can meet you and shake your hand at the finish line, and hopefully you're on the podium there.
Let's see, Sean. But yeah, it'd be great to see you in Hawaii. I'll look forward to getting there. You know, the hard work starts now, but by July I'll be ready for sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, that has been episode 45 of Speaking from Water with Stuart McLaughlin. And wherever you are, I hope you have a good day, good morning, good night. Peace.